Welcome. I'm delighted to see such a fine crowd here today. We think we have a program that you're going to enjoy very much. I'm Judy Pendel. I head the Center for Legal Policy of the Manhattan Institute. I'd like to first thank the New York City Chamber of Commerce, who were helpful to us in organizing this program today. I'd also like to mention that we have some handouts on the table as you leave the room. Please take note and take one with you. Without further ado, I'd like to bring to the podium someone who really needs no introduction to you, Peter Huber, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
When I arrived as a freshman at MIT in 1970, some 300 of us shared time on an IBM 1130. I remember the machine well. My daughter in her Dell, she's 11 years old, has, I'd say, somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times as much power on her desktop today. We communicated campus-wide on a system called Multics, which, as I recall, ran about 60 bits per second. My DSL line is now 1.6 megabits per second. My first Fortran program was 110 lines. I still have it. It's 110 lines of code. I was very proud of it. And I'm told that Microsoft Windows is now topping 30 million lines, though, of course, it depends how you define Microsoft Windows, whether you include the browser or not. this raises many questions. Among them is 30 million too many? Where does it stop, if ever? How will we know when it ought to stop? Who will decide and by what process? These are not easy questions. Some years ago, not 30 years ago, but some years ago, I did a crossfire debate on Microsoft's venality. I've forgotten most of the details of what we all said, except that our interlocutors at the time were Bill Press and John Sununu. And I was told, I cannot say this is necessarily true, but I was told when I arrived at the studio they had to flip a coin to decide which one would be on the right and which would be on the left on that one. And it was with some reluctance that one of them had taken one side, but I've forgotten which. Anyway, enough for me. We have today for the prosecution and for the defense, the authors of the two books you have on your table. I will introduce them very briefly, leaving more time for them to speak. For the prosecution or the plaintiff, we have Tom Leonard, who's vice president for research and senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, which is a counterpart to the Manhattan Institute based in Washington. Dr. Leonard previously served in government at the Office of Management and Budget, the Federal Trade Commission, the Council on Wage and Price Stability. He has an extensive and distinguished career on competitive matters, particularly those relating to the economics of high technology. I will also introduce Dr. Stanley Liebowitz for the defense, or the defendant. Though, of course, neither of our speakers today actually represent these parties. He is Dr. Liebowitz is currently a professor of managerial economics at the School of Management at the University of Texas at Dallas. He is the author of the other book on your table. He has an extensive list of academic publications. Among other things, he is one of the few people in the world who actually knows, because he's researched this with care, where the QWERTY keyboard came from, and it's not where you think it came from, suffice it to say. Read his book, you'll find out. Tom Leonard, to begin.
Thank you, Peter, and I'd like to thank the Manhattan Institute for arranging this talk, and Peter, who is a longtime friend of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, has participated in a lot of our events. I was thinking when he was talking about the prosecution and left and right, I guess I'm here for the prosecution, but it seems to me in this particular issue, the lines between left and right are not as clear as in some other instances. I'm usually probably identified with being on the right. On this side, let me just say that I hope I am speaking in the interest of competition in this particular industry. In any event, the Microsoft case obviously is going to, whatever the result, is going to be a landmark case in the history of antitrust, and it is going to essentially answer the question of whether there is a role for antitrust in the digital economy, and if there is one, what that role is going to be. Obviously, the information technology industries, the information technology sector, is one of the great economic success stories of our time. It's a fantastic engine for growth, productivity, increasing standards of living. However, the emergence of one company in an overwhelmingly dominant position in that industry is problematic as far as competition in that industry is concerned. The concern from an antitrust perspective is not simply that Microsoft has a monopoly in the operating system for personal computers. That is not illegal in and of itself, but rather that it uses that monopoly to raise barriers to entry, both in the market for operating systems as well as in complementary markets. That's a legitimate public policy concern, even for those who would generally favor a rather cautious antitrust policy. The recent findings of fact that the district court in Washington issued, Judge Penfield Jackson issued, show that what we have here in the Microsoft case is not just a business practice or two that have strayed over the line, but rather a broad anti-competitive campaign detailed in 200 pages of the judge's findings that was undertaken by Microsoft to protect and extend its operating system monopoly. So given the magnitude of the expenses, the remedy should be a serious one, not punitive, because there's obviously no point in that, but one that really does try to promote competition. But obviously, in crafting such a remedy, we need to be concerned about the dangers of regulating the software industry, which I don't think anybody is in favor of. I'm going to argue that a breakup, the right kind of a breakup of Microsoft, a restructuring of Microsoft, is both the most pro-competitive and at the same time the least regulatory of the available remedies. Obviously, the issue of remedy has to be seen in the context of what has been proven in the court, and notwithstanding the claims of Microsoft's defenders, I've from time to time have been on podiums with various Microsoft defenders, and one of the first things they all say is, "Well, Microsoft doesn't even have a monopoly." Well, for those of us who've been in a computer store recently, I would challenge any one of you to buy a computer that doesn't have Windows pre-installed. I mean, and the proof of Microsoft's monopoly in court has been overwhelming. Every year for the past decade, Microsoft has had over 90% of the market for PC operating systems. For the last couple of years, the market, they have had over 95%. So this is a durable monopoly which has persisted and expanded over time. There are no significant competitors. There are no substitutes. Even its large customers, Gateway, Dell, IBM, have no bargaining power with respect to Microsoft. And there are very high barriers to entry. This is not, as some would say, some people believe these high technology markets, notwithstanding the rapid pace of change, this is not a market where all you need is a couple of bright programmers in a garage to enter. It is very difficult to enter markets with these type of that have been dominated by a single firm, where you have all these types of network effects. Once a technology like Windows becomes dominant, a potential entrant finds itself faced with a large installed base of users who have a large supply of applications that have already been written for this program. The assurance that Programmers are going to continue writing programs for this program, for this operating system. Obviously, the incentive, especially given the cost structure of writing software programs, where the major cost is basically the first copy cost, the incentive to write programs for a new entrant operating system that may have a very, very small fraction of the market is not very significant. So a potential entrant would face a very high hurdle. There are significant switching costs to anybody who wants to switch to a new program. Entry is clearly not easy, and this, in fact, is why software firms have such large, at least the successful ones, have such large market capitalizations. And this is what Judge Jackson found, and in his findings, he said the entry of the new operating system was severely constrained by this technical term, the intractable chicken and egg problem, which he called the applications barrier to entry. Now, given this general scenario, once Navigator and Java, the competing browser in Java, a programming language, started to appear, Microsoft saw correctly that the immediate threat that they were, because essentially these were new technologies that could erode. Its monopoly, could erode the application's barrier to entry, because they are both examples of middleware, where you can write the programs to the middleware, and then those can be placed on top of a lot of different operating systems, and so the applications then become operating system neutral. They're not specific to a particular operating system, and that dramatically would erode Microsoft's market position. And obviously, they saw that threat. And Navigator was released first in December 1994, and in May 1995, Bill Gates wrote a memo that warned that Netscape was, quote, pursuing a multi-platform strategy where they move the key APIs into the client, the APIs being the application program interfaces, the hooks onto which the applications program are written for, key APIs into the client to commoditize the underlying operating system. So Microsoft had a clear incentive to engage in exclusionary practices to protect the operating system monopoly against these threats, even at the cost of large foregone profits. And it also had the ability, by leveraging its operating system monopoly, to do so. After initially trying and failing to gain a market division agreement with Netscape, essentially to keep Netscape out of the Windows market, Microsoft followed a strategy of leveraging its operating system monopoly to block Netscape using a variety of means, pricing, contractual, and technological, essentially to block Netscape from the two main avenues through which virtually everybody gets their browser. They either get it, it's either the OEM market, the original equipment manufacturing market, or the internet access market. Those are the two ways that almost everybody gets their browser, either pre-installed with the machine that they buy or from their internet access provider like AOL. Obviously, with respect to the equipment manufacturers, the OEMs, they all need Windows. They can't be in business without a Windows license, without having Windows installed on their machine. So it's pretty easy to say, if you want a license, you have to take Internet Explorer and you have to not sell Navigator. That's essentially what happened, although the judge went on for many, many pages in his findings detailing how Microsoft's forced the OEMs to take the Internet Explorer with Windows, forbade them to remove it or obscure it, imposed a variety of technical restrictions to increase the cost of promoting Navigator, threatened to penalize OEMs that insisted on pre-installing and promoting it. On the other side, on the internet access, Microsoft gave valuable considerations to internet access providers that agreed to distribute the Explorer either exclusively or virtually. Exclusively, for example, they made a deal with America Online where they would distribute AOL software in Windows. They gave AOL valuable placement on the Microsoft desktop in competition with its own access provider, Microsoft Network, essentially sacrificed Microsoft Network to this effort. They even gave them direct payments, all of this to promote a product that they were giving away for free, Internet Explorer. Now, this strategy was successful before 1996. Navigator had substantial and growing presence on the desktop of new personal computers. By January 1998, of the 60 original equipment manufacturer sub-channels that the judge talks about in his findings, 15 OEMs, each of which, and four sub-channels for each, Navigator was being shipped on only four, mostly with the icon not on the desktop. For example, Sony featured Navigator in a folder rather than on the desktop, and Gateway shipped a separate CD, so didn't even, rather than pre-installing it. So by 1999, Navigator was present on only a very tiny fraction of the computers that were shipped. So Microsoft clearly won the browser war. They have a share of over 60% as people continue to upgrade Windows that will go rapidly upward. And these are not the only threats that Microsoft dealt with. They were able to convince companies like Intel, for example. Intel was developing software that it provided directly to the OEMs and other purchasers of Intel chips. Microsoft was concerned about that again eroded its position. They were able to convince Intel to stop doing that. IBM was in competition with Microsoft on the software side of the market with Microsoft punished the personal computer arm of IBM with higher prices for the Windows license, a delayed license for Windows 95, and withholding of technical and marketing support. In the latter half of the 1990s, IBM, along with Gateway, paid significantly more for Windows than other major OEMs like Compaq, Dell, and HP that were more compliant with Microsoft's wishes. Now, the cost of all this to consumers, there are a variety of costs of all this to consumers. First of all, prices are higher. Microsoft acknowledged that essentially that its pricing decisions were basically unconstrained by competition. They have extraordinary profit margins compared to other firms in the computer and software industry. The evidence was of a trial was that their profit margin on sales was close to 40%. The most recent quarter was over 50%. There's a memo that was produced at trial saying they could have profitably sold Windows at $49, but they charged $89 instead. But I think probably the most important costs to consumers really are in the effect that this entire arrangement has had on innovation. It's obviously harder to quantify. But there is now no threat of competition in the personal computer operating system market, either directly or from middleware like a competing browser or Java. There is a lack of differentiation between the offerings of personal computer manufacturers due to the contractual restrictions imposed by Microsoft. You buy a computer from virtually anybody and you go home and you boot it up and it looks pretty much the same. Microsoft devotes a considerable amount of its efforts, its research efforts and its marketing efforts to maintaining and extending its monopoly, and obviously that's a rational thing for it to do. Those profits are really pretty hefty, and they devote a considerable amount of their efforts to maintaining that rather than meeting customer needs, because customers really have no place else to go. Microsoft dictates the innovation schedule for both applications and hardware, and the judge found that that results in some innovations never occurring. And of course, the market is distorted by the fact that that firms stay out of areas where Microsoft is likely to be dominant. Well, all that brings us to the question of what to do about this, which is obviously a difficult issue. I'm going to propose a remedy that I think that is consistent with two statements, one by Judge Posner, hopefully consistent by Judge Posner, and one by Bill Gates. Judge Posner said that in his well-known book on antitrust, that the proper purpose of the antitrust laws is to promote competition, as that term is understood in economics. Bill Gates has said that Microsoft can never accept any remedy that limits its ability to design software. 1 minute. Okay. Peter told me he was going to be a little flexible. move to the remedy. I mean, there's a whole range of conduct remedies, ranging from conduct to structural remedies. And the big disadvantage of the conduct remedies is that it is hard to see how you could have a conduct remedy that actually addresses the problems, addresses the findings of the court, without basically having the government looking over Microsoft's shoulders every step of the way, both with respect to its business practices and with respect to its even extending to its design decisions. Now, the structural remedies, and the structural remedies are of various kinds. The one that has been talked about a lot is kind of an AT&T solution, where you kind of cut the firm in half with separate the applications part of the firm from the operating part of the firm. There are two problems with that. One is it doesn't address the issue of the operating system monopoly, because the operating system monopoly remains. And secondly, for a variety of reasons, you'd have to supplement that with conduct remedies, just as you did in the AT&T case, so you wouldn't overcome the problem with conduct remedies. The one solution that's suggested, and I can't say it's original with me, it's been suggested by several people, is kind of a hybrid solution where the other structural remedy is kind of a vertical solution where you just cut the firm in thirds, where every three equal firms. But that's a little extreme, given the fact that the case has only been about the operating system, not about the rest. So that leads us to a hybrid solution where you have you separate the applications from the operating system, and then you divide the operating system system in thirds, and essentially give all, you'd have three identical operating system firms that would be competing with each other. And you'd have the applications firm as a separate firm. And the nice thing about this is it would require very, very minimal supervision. You'd have to have a transition period that essentially to assure that the firms don't recombine in some way or another, and during the first 3 years, that they don't just undo the effects of the decree. But even after a few years, you wouldn't even have to have that, because the industry would have changed so much. So you'd have to have virtually no supervision by the Justice Department or the court, and it would really kickstart competition in this area. You would have three operating system firms competing with each other, and you'd have you'd have price declines, you'd have much more service to customers, you'd have I think probably a big wave of new innovation that would get started, and without the downsides of having government supervision over the software industry. And why don't I stop there?